Okay, so now I will introduce our main speaker, Bassam Haddad. He's director of Middle East Studies program and teaches in the Department of Public and International Affairs at George Mason University. He's a visiting professor at Georgetown University. He serves as a founding editor of the Arab Studies Journal, a peer-reviewed research publication, and is a co-product producer, director of the award-winning documentary film About Baghdad, and director of a critical acclaimed film series on Arabs and terrorism, based on extensive field research and interviews. More recently, Bassam directed a film on Arab Muslim immigrants in Europe, titled The Other Threat. Bassam also serves on the editorial committee of Middle East Report and is co-founder of Jadalia. He also recently published a book, Business Networks in Syria, The Political Economy of Authoritarianism. We will try today to look at the structural causes of the emergence of the Syrian uprising and the factors that explain the stalemate thus far today. We're going to have a critical discussion and look at this uprising from different point of view. Like we're going to try to answer many questions. Many people I meet here, they say, oh, it's too complicated, I don't understand this uprising, I can't, like, you know, it's very complicated. So hopefully today we'll try to answer some of these questions and try to find, you know, solutions and answers. Some of the questions that we'll try to answer is this popular uprising just a conspiracy, as the regime says, or is it an uprising for freedom? Are the people on the streets agents of, I don't know, or criminals, like these kids of 14, 12 years old who wrote on the wall, we ask for the overthrow of the regime, are actually CIA agents? I don't know. Like, we'll answer this question. We'll look at this more quickly. What is the role of the Western states, Israel, and the regimes, the Arab regime, conservative regime in the uprising? What are their interests in supporting the uprising? Why, like, countries like Canada, Canada's based conservative government, which is like not so friendly with self-determination with the Palestinian people, for example, but voices like support to the to this uprising, you know, is militarization the way to go? Is international intervention the way to go? Or there's other solutions? Finally, and we would like to also look at the what will this uprising, what the impact of this uprising will have regionally on the resistance against colonialism and Zionism in the region and on the liberation of Palestine. So many things we'll look at. I will let I will invite Bassam to the podium and after he finishes we'll have the question and answer period where we can answer all the questions hopefully that you have. Okay, thank you.
Thank you all for coming, and thanks to the organizers and to Rami for inviting me. I'm destroying the podium now. Can you hear me? I really prefer not to use the microphone. Okay, because the microphone is loud and not very necessary. As you probably know, there is a lot of confusion about the Syrian uprising, and this makes sense for a number of reasons why there might be some confusion. But I do not think that we are facing a situation that is an impossibility in ways, or that is difficult to understand to the point where we cannot make out any rational sense of what is happening. There are confusing issues, largely because the issue is wrapped up in local, regional, and international matters. But I think we could, based on principle, political and otherwise, make some claims that I think we can stand by, especially those of us who are interested in checking power and opposing repression, who are against social injustice, economic, political, or otherwise. Those of us who look at various causes out there that we believe in, including, of course, fighting all forms of apartheid, I think we could come to some basic understandings of what needs to be done, what needs to be thought at some level, with some leeway for a spectrum that represents various people. But I will start with one thing, that is, we really cannot, as a result of the complexity of the situation, however much we would like to talk about regional and international pressures, however much we want to talk about Israel's apartheid, American hegemony and domination, and its duplicitous and hypocritical policies, however much we want to talk about anything outside Syria that might affect the situation, and I will talk about it, and I will be quite stern in talking about it, but however much we bring in matters to the issue, we should not absolve the dictatorship of the regime. In other words, that is one constant that we cannot simply write off because there are horrible actors like Israel or the United States foreign policy. And I think as a matter of principle, whatever we do and however much we would like to discuss this matter, we cannot absolve the repression that has been taking place for decades. So this is actually at the crux of the problems, not just, you know, in the media or especially in the region, but also between myself and various friends and family. We differ on various issues, but unfortunately, some would like to use this opportunity to absolve the regime. I reject absolving the regime of the crimes that have been committed for decades. This does not mean that what is happening in Syria in terms of the uprising and who supports the uprising and for what ends is something that we should take for granted that it's a pro-democracy movement. And on the contrary, we really should be as stern with and as careful with simply taking the uprising at face value, right? So we have to have this pretty difficult take up this pretty difficult position where we understand the uprising as something that has nothing to do in its original form, in its theoretical form, in its abstract form, in its empirical form. Originally, it has nothing to do with all these other things, and it has everything to do with the 4 to 5 decades of continuous political repression, and then of late, speaking of the past 15 to 20 years, of the economic deterioration and the social polarization that has taken place as a result of the regime's connection and partnership with usually the upper echelons of the business class in Syria that created this social inequality that was never part of the original regime that came to power in 1963, which is the Ba'ath Party. In fact, when it came to power, it was allied with labor, with the masses, and it was pushing for state welfare. It was pushing for labor rights. It actually marginalized the business community. This went on for 2.5 decades or 2 decades, depending on where the transition took place, in your view, in the 1980s. And then the regime shifted or switched alliances and started working with members of the business community selectively and informally to actually bring the Syrian economy down to new heights, which actually began to tear the fabric of Syrian society. Locally, of course, I mean in the cities, but mainly in the countryside, where the countryside was completely neglected as a result of its economic policies since the 1980s. So we're talking about political repression, we're talking about economic disenfranchisement, and then we're talking recently about matters of dignity, where people's dignity was affected. Not just the fact that they could not vote or speak out, not just the fact that they could no longer rely on subsidies, on basic foods or basic services, especially after 2005 when Bashar Assad and the regime announced the social market economy, which is a sloppy mixture of market and state policies, and state subsidies were basically withdrawn one at a time. All of these things actually produced the background to what we are seeing today. The fact that the uprising was, according to some, hijacked, or according to others, diluted, or according to others, infiltrated, is something that should cause us to take a pause before we wholeheartedly support the entire uprising with the entire opposition members and institutions, but not necessarily, of course, and not at all, in fact, not absolve the regime. So this is the problem. The problem is that people try to see one side of the formula and ignore the other. And that's why people within families, including my own family, have differences in terms of what, how we interpret the matter. And I think those of us who are fortunate enough not to be under bombs and bullets can actually sit and discuss this in a civil manner. We will disagree. I will not like what some people have to say. You will not like some of what I have to say. But I hope that if we zoom out, pull back, look at the larger picture, the differences will not be as huge as they seem to be sometimes. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the current situation and then move to discussing the causes, the structural causes, which I kind of discussed a little bit of the uprising. I will talk a little bit about why is it that the regime is still in power after 1 year of continuous protest, which is something that is unprecedented given the other cases that we've witnessed. And I'll talk about the stalemate that we are witnessing, and then finally I'll discuss where we might be going. I hope to leave as much room as possible for questions and answers and discussion, because I think, judging from whom I know, in terms of the audience and the kinds of interests people have, I think this is not just an intellectual issue, and it's not even just a political issue. It's also a personal issue for many of you who have relatives in Syria, including myself. So, and then of course the theme of this larger, you know, the Apartheid Week and Tadamun's message and resistance will also be part and parcel of my concluding comments, because as much as we would like to connect what is happening to the question of Palestine, and there is room to connect it, we have to recognize where analytically these things are separate and where politically they come together. The initial momentum and the initial spark for people to actually say something in Syria against the regime is independent of the apartheid state of Israel and its practices. The manner in which this has developed and is not necessarily independent, because when international actors intervened and regional actors intervened, there were other considerations being made, and they do involve the security of the state of Israel, and they do involve the security of the other Arab dictatorships that are now speaking in the name of democracy, and they do involve the interests of the United States, which itself has supported dictatorship for 4 and 5 decades in the region and supported the brutal repression of hundreds of millions of people in the region, and now is bringing to the table this issue of democracy and fighting dictatorship, at the same time that the United States blessed Saudi Arabia's deployment of troops in Bahrain to repress the opposition and repress the Bahraini revolution against the Bahraini state. So it's very important to not look at those of us who criticize the support of the opposition by various international and regional players as something that is simply based on ideology. It's based on the fact that these players don't give a damn about the Syrian population or Syrian democracy, and they are preserving their own interests, and there is a simple intersection between them and the opposition. And it's not an organic intersection. It's not even a strategic intersection. It's a tactical intersection that helps them reorder relations of power in the region. And if we recognize this,
we will be able to decipher when and how we should actually fight the regime, and who should we support in fighting the regime, and who we should not support in fighting the regime, even if others say, well, then you are blessing the killing of people in Syria. We are not blessing the killing of people in Syria by the regime. We are simply aware of the intersection of the local and the regional and international. And if we are faulted for this, then that's fine. So I'll start with talking a little bit about the current situation. As you probably know, all uprisings are complex, not just the Syrian uprising. But the reason why the Syrian uprising is especially complex is that it is, or it has an added complexity, is that it is pivotal to various historical struggles and conflicts in the region. This is the simple matter. It is at the intersection of various struggles in the region. Libya wasn't at the intersection of these struggles. Neither was Tunisia, nor Egypt, nor Bahrain, nor was Yemen. They are at the intersection of smaller and more local struggles, but they're not at the intersection of regional and international struggles. Syria is. And namely, it is at the intersection of a struggle in which it is an enabler of resistance, much more so of an agent of resistance. It's an enabler of resistance to American hegemony and domination in the region. It's an enabler of resistance against the apartheid state of Israel. And it forms an axis with Iran that is very much the target of certain countries, namely the United States and Israel and some European countries, because they basically constitute an impediment to a stable Middle East according to these powers. And in that sense, the Syrian regime and the uprising and the entire events and conflict and what we are witnessing today is more than just about Syria. This unfortunately explains the protracted nature of the Syrian uprising. We are coming up to the year anniversary of the killing, and we do not see, unless somebody in the audience sees something that I don't, we do not see the regime falling tomorrow. We do not see an imminent end of this uprising anytime very soon. The other problem is that the undesirable nature of all the trade-offs involved in this situation. In other words, one of the things I would like to close with is that, and I will open with it as well, because this is the hard reality that unless we recognize it, we will be, in la-la land. And that is, there are no good and bad alternatives in this current situation. There are horrible alternatives and catastrophic alternatives. And that's something that if we don't recognize, we're going to keep aiming for the good alternative, and we're never going to find it. And we're going to call everyone else criminals or traitors or what have you because of our desire for a decent alternative. There is no decent alternative. And unless we get rid of that, I think we will continue to bicker about things that are extremely academic and irrelevant to what's happening on the ground. And even though this is a negative and a pessimistic outlook, it actually helps us work together to achieve the suboptimal. Because if we continue to work to achieve the optimal solution, we're not going to get anywhere. And in fact, more people will actually die and pay the price. So we have, in short, very quickly, a local, regional, and international stalemate today. Locally, we have a stalemate between the state, the regime, and the entire opposition, and I'll talk about the opposition in a little bit more detail. And that is something that's causing the local stalemate on the ground in the battlefield. And I'll talk about this in a little while. Secondly, we are no longer witnessing a clear-cut event where you have a pro-democracy movement fighting a dictatorship. We do have a fight against dictatorship, but we no longer have a classical, benevolent, anti-dictatorial, pro-democracy movement. We have something that is a bit more mixed at this point. And it doesn't mean that we cannot support some aspects of this opposition. We should support aspects of this opposition if we believe in the fight against dictatorship. But I would like to note that if we don't pay attention to what's happening within this glob of things we call the opposition, we will be actually doing a disservice to the long-term well-being of Syrians. Thirdly, we also no longer are witnessing a local event. It's a regional and international event. And I would like to focus on this yet again, also down the line in a little bit. And the uprising finally involves the question of Palestine, as I shared later. It involves, as I shared earlier, it involves the balance of power in the region. We're talking about regional balance of power, not what external or international forces want. We're talking about Saudi Arabia and Qatar and their allies in the region versus Syria, Iran, Hezbollah, and other allies of theirs in the region. Actually, that's about it for the second camp. And then we're talking about international forces, that's the third level, that are attempting to leverage their power in a region that is changing, in a region where the United States has lost already two of its clients, one major client, which is Egypt. Not lost it completely, because we are witnessing attempts by Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the military dictatorship in Egypt, along with their allies in Europe and specifically in the United States, we're witnessing attempts at what we can call counter-revolution, to roll back the progress of the revolution, not just in Egypt, but also everywhere in the region. We're also witnessing attempts by these very same countries to make sure that Syria is the Syria, Yemen, and Bahrain is where it stops, whereby the stability of the region that was based for decades on dictatorial regimes, supported, bankrolled, and militarized, as in weaponized by especially the United States, is restored to the pre-uprising, the pre-Bouazizi self-immolation period. And that is an almost invisible trend that many are not talking about, because we are rightly busy looking at what's happening in Syria, rightly busy looking at how SCAF, the Supreme Council for the Armed Force of the Armed Forces in Egypt, is actually trying to reweave the Hosni Mubarak dictatorship, but in a nicer, with a nicer embalage. And we are missing what is happening regionally, which is this counter-revolutionary movement headed by Qatar and Saudi Arabia with their international allies. And that is going to constitute the most significant danger, not just for some countries, but for the entire region for many, many years to come. Because, as you know, the rest of the Arab states are also dictatorships that are not necessarily or not at all serving their populations. So the four questions I'd like to ask and quickly try to offer not a full answer, not an exhaustive answer, but some idea of where we should focus on in answering them. First, what explains the Syrian uprising? I just concluded in the fall, well, last year, last summer, my book on Syria, which I've been researching since 1995, 94, and it just came out in November. It's titled Business Networks, the Political Economy of Authoritarian Resilience. And in my book, my principal focus was on how the state in Syria, as well as in other countries in the developing world, after its state public sector fails in the 70s or 80s, and sometimes late 80s, but after these countries' public sector fails, the sector that the state actually supports and uses to actually control the livelihood of various of populations, the state begins shifting its alliances and starts allying itself with members of the business community in order to keep itself alive and in order to actually bring in investments and, of course, in light of the international arena, in order to actually do good in terms of the United States push for neoliberal reforms, especially after the Soviet Union fell in 1990. So the point is that the entire developing world, and most countries certainly for the most part, have actually moved from a more left coalition, even though it's authoritarian, but it's more left coalition, to a more right coalition. And that move involves taking away a lot of the rights, a lot of the privileges that the masses were actually enjoying in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, even if in an imperfect way. So the Syrian regime, in actually coming together with the business community, began to change policies that for decades, or at least for a couple of decades, 2 to 3 decades, had supported the majority of Syrians, to policies that support the minority of Syrians, whereby the rest are kept under control through various repressive mechanisms. And that shift actually did two things in Syria structurally. And this is what I'd like to focus on, not because it is the cause of the uprising, but because without looking at these shifts, we will not understand the intensity of the uprising, and we will not understand why it is more intense in some areas as opposed to others. So the two dynamics that actually produced this discontent are, first, social polarization. In other words, the effect of these policies, of the state business policies that started in the mid to late 1980s until recently, is that it created a larger gap between the rich and poor, between the haves and the have-nots. And this is, I know, a basic and crude discussion. It's something that, you know, requires a lot of unpacking. But the short of it is that it created social polarization, whereby the middle class was slowly dissipating, fading away. And this is a dynamic that's also happening in all countries, including the United States. And I'm pretty sure in Canada, we are also witnessing the shrinking of the middle class, the unbelievable enrichment of a small sliver of the population up top, and then basically the disenfranchisement of a large sector of the population. In developing countries and in dictatorships, this process is especially dangerous and costly, largely because there are no mechanisms for redress. There's nowhere to go to actually stop this process. And if you go to the streets, you're shot. And if you are rational, you will not go to the streets because you will be shot and nothing will happen. Of course, the Arab uprisings show that there comes a time when enough people are ready to go to the streets, ready to be shot at the same time, and that's why revolutions or uprisings succeed. In the case of Syria, it wasn't completely ripe for that kind of ripe. I said mistwiyi in Arabic, for that kind of movement. So it's sort of in between. In other words, in the case of Syria, had Bouazizi not immolated himself and had Tunisia and Egypt not taken place, basically a successful mass mobilization against the head of state, because it's not a revolution really that happened, it's not even a regime change. We have the removal of the head of state in those countries. But had this not happened, the Dara'a kids who wrote on the wall, "Al-Sha'b yurid sqat al-Nizam," would have been tortured or maybe even killed or what have you, and nothing would have happened. If this happened in 2008, everyone in this audience who knows Syria knows that these things have happened in the past 20 or 30 years and people just disappeared and nothing happened. But because of the domino effect, because of the mass awareness in Syria that this has happened elsewhere and this is an opportunity to make it happen here, we actually had a mass uprising, except that it wasn't as ubiquitous as many of the protesters and many of us maybe wanted to see. So this social polarization had a major impact on putting everyone at the same level in terms of their discontent vis-a-vis what is happening in those countries. But that's not enough. There's another dynamic, especially in Syria, but also in Tunisia and Egypt, and that is, since the 1980s, these policies have not only enriched some people, but they have also impoverished and devastated the countryside at the expense, have devastated the countryside and for the most part supported the major cities, the major metropolitan cities, not even all cities. So we see that Damascus and Aleppo, since the 1980s, have flourished a lot more than other cities, and that took place at the expense of the devastation of the countryside, which is exactly where the uprising started, which is where the uprising is most intense. And then, of course, it moved to the smaller cities, not the bigger cities, to become the hub of the uprising in Homs today and other smaller cities like Hama, also in the north and, of course, in the south in Dara'a. So we see a polarization, a vertical polarization between rich and poor, a horizontal polarization between the countryside and the city, that actually was an explosive combination, especially in the countryside, because people in the countryside were affected by both processes. They were impoverished in general, and they impoverished as members, as you know, inhabitants of the countryside. And this is why that spark took place in the countryside, not only in Syria, but also in Tunisia. If you were paying attention, you know, many of us didn't pay attention to what's happening in Tunisia until January 5th or 4th. But it started in December 17th, 2010, after Bouazizi immolated himself. Those of us who were watching, and we at Jadaliya, we were watching this process so that at the moment we began to see the transition, we started writing about it. Jadaliya is the e-zine that we actually started just a few months before the uprising and became a go-to place for analysis on the region, especially indigenous analysis or analysis by people who are intimately connected with the region. When we were watching, observing this December 17th self-immolation and what happened next, we were all aware of the fact that it actually happened in the neglected countryside. And then it moved to Tunis, the capital. Those of you who were not paying attention also did not notice that in Egypt, it also started not in the city, not in the metropolitan major city of Cairo. It started in Port Said, it started in Ismailia, and then moved to the city, to Tahrir Square. So it's also important to see and to note these processes that people don't pay attention to simply because the killing is horrendous and the repression is horrendous. But it's important to recognize these as the structural, as some of the important structural causes, not the only causes, but without understanding these causes, we will have an inadequate understanding of these uprisings. And we will simply think about this as a uprising against dictatorship. It's not just an uprising against dictatorship. Authoritarianism doesn't make people go to the street and fight. Otherwise, why didn't it do it in 1968, 1973, 1979, 1984, 1991, 1998, 2004, 2008? There are things that happen other than authoritarianism that actually lead to mass mobilization that is irreversible. Not the kind that happened in 1982 when the regime actually killed tens of thousands of people, because we don't know the exact number in Syria, but an irreversible mass mobilization. And that only happens when you have a number of elements, including political repression, which is a necessary but insufficient cause for mass mobilization. So you have to have political repression. We also have, in this case, economic deterioration and disenfranchisement. When you took away almost everything from a good number of the Syrian people in terms of their salary, largely because of inflation and because it's actually not keeping up with the prices that are rising irrespective of inflation even. When you take away also their subsidies, especially for a certain class of the Syrian people, when you take away the subsidies that they depended on, not in the sense that in the United States we people depend on subsidies and welfare. Subsidies and welfare in developing countries are not, as some call them in the United States, handouts by the state. Subsidies and welfare in developing countries, including Syria, are considered rights. Rights that people actually have since the 1950s, when a contract, a social and political contract, was actually established between state and society, that this is people's rights. When you start taking this away, which is something that started in Egypt and Tunisia and Syria at differential times, but definitely included all of these countries in the 2000s, you are not leaving a lot of room for people to breathe, and you are bound to actually produce discontent that's based on political repression, economic disenfranchisement, which are not enough, again, I hate to say, to produce mass mobilization. What happens usually is that these two elements end up taking away people's rights to the point where people's dignities become affected. People don't go to the streets and fight bullets because they are not doing well financially, or because there is corruption at the top, or because there is repression and you can't form your own political party. People go to the streets when their dignity is affected in a profound manner that they are willing to fight bullets with their bodies. And that's precisely the condition that was almost ubiquitous in some countries in the region. And to be analytically sober, this is also why in some countries we haven't seen that movement. I mean, we've seen skirmishes in some oil-rich countries, and we've seen Bahraini uprising starting because there it was mixed with other matters. But in countries like Kuwait and the UAE and Oman and Saudi Arabia, you know, precluding the Rub' al-Khali uprisings that are not ubiquitous, we haven't seen that because these elements are just not there yet, even though it's an authoritarian regime. So this is what happened in most of these countries. We have a collection of factors that ended up stripping people, or many people, of their dignity. And I hate to say this, that was not enough either for people to go to the streets. And I'm not being you know, silly or joking. It's not enough because people, we cannot predict revolutions. Analysts, academics, political scientists, you know, people who try to predict everything in terms of social life and political life cannot predict revolutions because these structural conditions that produce discontent are not themselves sufficient to just produce the revolution or mass mobilization. What usually happens is that there is some sort of event that sparks all of this and creates a moment where everybody recognizes, or most people recognize at a particular moment, that this is the opportunity to actually act. And that's when you see an irreversible mass mobilization. That's precisely what happened in Tunisia after Bouazizi immolated himself, and after people protested, and after they were crushed. You began to see a level of awareness that couldn't have actually happened without everything that I'm discussing with you. But of course, I'm bringing up the case of Syria. But the same processes took place in Tunisia and Egypt, even if there are differences. We can talk about the differences. But in Syria, that was the spark. It took a while, because if you know Syria, going to the streets to oppose or to speak out against the regime is not a very rational thing to do unless you are confident that you will be joined by a lot of people. And this is why it took a while, but also it's the reason why it did not move very quickly, and it did not include all of Syria at the same time, especially Aleppo and Damascus, even though now we're beginning to see this happening. And that's largely because the situation in Syria was not as ripe as it is in, let's say, Egypt. So I just wanted to bring that up so that we can also move away a little bit from polemics. When we talk about the Syrian situation, we're not just talking about political repression. We're also talking about a regime that was supposedly on the left, that is supposedly socialist by constitution or in the constitution, moving to actually strip away the same people and the same social groups that it supported early on. So this is something that I'd like to focus on. And I'll leave it at that. The second question is the resilience of the Syrian regime. Why is the Syrian regime not falling apart? Why is it that in Egypt you had a regime that fell apart within, 18 days? Similar time period in Tunisia. Why did the Syrian regime basically endure until today, and there's no signs that it's going to actually fall apart anytime soon? Now, the reasons are many, and many of us who don't like the Syrian regime or don't like dictatorship can point to, maybe dozens of reasons. But if you want to look at the structural factors, again, I'd like to move the discussion away from polemics. Let's forget for a moment that this is really a bad regime. I mean, the word bad and authoritarian and dictatorship are all true. But why is it that this regime has endured? I'd like to talk about two things. I'd like to talk about the nature of the regime in Syria as compared to Tunisia and Egypt, and I'd like to talk about Syrian society in terms of its composition as compared to some other countries that experienced uprisings. On the one hand, the Syrian regime is actually far more coherent and cohesive and organic internally compared to the Egyptian regime and compared to the Tunisian regime. In the sense that within the Syrian regime, which is a collection of institutions whereby you have the party, the bureaucracy, the army, the security services, and then the top leadership, the political leadership, these different elements of any regime in Syria are far more cohesive. They're like this, in the sense that the authority an autonomy of each of these elements has been emptied out and is now vested primarily in the security services and in the top leadership in Syria. And that prevents the kinds of options that took place or that we witnessed in Tunisia and Egypt, in the sense that in Tunisia and Egypt, there was a possibility, in fact, it did happen, whereby the military or the security services or a collection of these elements can actually come to the president, and there's never just a president, it's the president and the top elite. They can come to the president and say, your departure is going to solve the problem, at least temporarily, and it's going to allow the regime to maintain itself and actually potentially restore itself. And that is the only solution at the time. This possibility doesn't exist in Syria. As many of you know, no institution in Syria has the independence to actually formulate an independent decision or demand of the sort. It's not that there is a possibility for this decision to be formulated and then people choose not to formulate it. It just does not arise because of the emptying out of authority from these institutions from the 1970s. Those of you who know the history of Syria, the Ba'ath came to power in 1963. And the Ba'ath itself was purged of various elements that were considered problematic or an impediment to what the top leaders wanted to do. And to do this, the military was brought in Syria to make the Ba'ath less and less relevant as a party and as an ideology. And then when Assad came to power in 1970, 1971, and established the collective movement, what happened was that the authority that was vested in the army at the expense of the party was even taken out of the army and placed in the narrower, smaller, but more fierce and focused security services. And that became the locus of authority in Syria. Not the army, not the party, not the bureaucracy. And that is precisely why for decades, things were actually ruled in a manner that was quite different, even though it's similar in some ways, but quite different from the dictatorship in Egypt. It's closer, a little bit closer to Tunisia, except that in Syria there indeed was an attempt to connect with society at various levels throughout the years. Whereas in Tunisia, that attempt was not as strong. And as opposed to the case of Libya, where the nutty dictator there actually severed all relations with society and destroyed all institutions that link state and society. That's why there was no one to help Gaddafi during the last days. He had to actually pay for people to come and fight for him. In Syria, it's quite different. There will be people who will fight for the Syrian regime, and not all of them are direct beneficiaries, and we'll talk about this in a second. So the regime in Syria is quite cohesive, and it's not likely to endure or is not likely to experience splits, at least not at this level of conflict. What that means is that the competition, that the conflict and the fight is fierce. There is no option. It's all or nothing. The regime stays altogether or leaves altogether, which makes the Arab League's plan to have Bashar leave and Farouk al-Sharia, the vice president, take over for a transitional government is silly and is actually disingenuous, because if I know this, they know this, that it's not possible. But the Arab League's plan from the very beginning was to try to do something and to register that they tried to do something locally and Arab-wise before going to the United Nations. And of course, the observers' mission, whereby they sent few people, unarmed, of course, unprotected largely, except for by the Syrian regime, to observe what's happening with orange vests, that's actually quite laughable. So on the one hand, you have a very coherent and cohesive regime. On the other hand, you have a society in Syria that is quite heterogeneous. It is not homogeneous. It's heterogeneous in terms of sect, in terms of ethnicity, in terms of region, in terms of class. And of course, some of these elements exist in other countries like Egypt and Tunisia, but the heterogeneity that exists in Syria in terms of sect and ethnicity, maybe not region and class, is actually far more present in Syria. So you do not have, first of all, the kind of automatic collective action that's going to take place, largely because the regime over the years has taken this heterogeneity and instead of using it as a to actually celebrate pluralism, right, it was actually manipulated in various ways. So you have the Christian minority in Syria that is supportive not necessarily of the regime and of Assad, but of the status quo because they feel that they feel that they will fare better, they will do better under a minoritarian regime than they will fare under a majoritarian regime. Same thing for the rest, the Shi'is, the Ismailis, and the rest. The Kurds, even though they're Sunni, for instance, they are also not Arab, so they also have concerns about majoritarian leaderships. Those concerns were actually exacerbated by the regime, and then they were exacerbated by some of the opposition in the 70s, whereby people felt that if that opposition, the Muslim Brotherhood, captured power, they will not be as open to them as minorities as the current regime. And the same game is being replayed. So you don't have in Syria a 10% Alawi population against the 90%. You have a much more balanced picture. You can like it or you can dislike it, but the reality is that we do have a large number of people that support, again, not necessarily the regime, but the status quo, whereby there is a lot of respect and there is a lot of a protection for various minorities. Maybe not political freedoms, maybe not, you know, economic opportunities for everyone, but it is one of the ways that the regime has been able to present itself as protector of minorities. So you do have about 25 to 30% of the Syrian people, at least, that support the status quo or would like to return to a status quo. Some people say it's 40 and 50%, because if you add to the minorities, sectarian and ethnic ethnicity, if you add the Sunnis that actually are direct beneficiaries from the regime, but the beneficiaries of the regime, either because they are business partners or because they are actually among the upper classes and are concerned about how any government afterwards, whether it's Sunni dominated, Muslim Brotherhood dominated, or even secular, they are concerned whether it's going to have the same chances that it has now. The Syrian regime is socialist, supposedly, in terms of its constitution, but it's thoroughly state capitalist in terms of its behavior in the past 20 years. And people who belong to certain classes are also very concerned about what might happen next, especially those in Aleppo and in Damascus. It doesn't mean that all rich people support or are against change. It just means that there is a class dimension as well. So we cannot talk about Syria just from a sectarian perspective like people do in the United States, in mainstream media, on CNN and elsewhere. And that doesn't mean that there are no sectarianism in Syria and the regime is anti-sectarian completely. It's just not the best lens to see the situation. So with the regime being cohesive and difficult to move, and with this heterogeneity at the level of society, you basically have a lesser ability to engage in collective action in society. And that impediment we see especially in the opposition. The opposition internally is actually, for the most part, an opposition to a dictatorship. Whether or not they have called for foreign intervention or they have made mistakes in some of their claims, that's actually far more forgivable because they are under the gun. But the opposition outside Syria has been completely unable to create consensus, to create autonomy for the opposition, to push out hypocritical and dictatorial states that pretend to support the Syrian revolution, and have been unable to condemn the sectarianism that is taking place in Syria by some of the opposition. That's why the dominant opposition outside Syria, specifically the Syrian National Council, and specifically its core, because the SNC has a lot of decent people that work with the SNC, but are not in power. In fact, a lot of people have left the SNC, friends of mine, because they felt that the SNC is not as transparent as it needs to be as an opposition movement, as a revolutionary movement. So when we talk about the opposition, we're talking about a number of oppositions, parties or groups, including the SNC. And when we talk about the SNC, we're not talking about an organization where everyone agrees on the basically the goals of the SNC and the revolution. There are a lot of splits, as many of you know, within the SNC on various questions, including the question of the dominance of the Muslim Brotherhood, the question of transparency of the processes inside the SNC, the democratic or non-democratic processes. There is conflict over the question of secularism. There's conflict over the question of foreign intervention, which kind of now ended. And there were early on conflicts over the question of the use of violence. As you know, Burhan Ghalioun and the SNC, when it started, there were three no's that animated its position. No to sectarianism, no to violence, no to external intervention. So no to external intervention and no to violence have actually slipped. And we have an SNC that supports violence against the state. And, you know, I don't see how one can do otherwise. Generally speaking, the question is, where is this violence headed and who is financing it and for what purposes? And then, of course, no to foreign intervention was dropped because of the SNC, not just because of the brutality of the regime, but because of the SNC's commitment, the core of the SNC's commitment to work with certain nations like Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United States, who have other interests than the long-term welfare of the Syrian people. Now, it's also important to, in this picture, to realize that this stalemate internally is, this situation internally produces the regime's ability or resilience to stay in power. And it causes a stalemate. And the stalemate is local, but it's also regional and international, because the regime is supported by Iran and Hezbollah regionally, and quite a bit of the Arab masses who do not support the regime, but who do not also support the opposition, the external international opposition against the regime, which they see also as Syria. So it's a very complex situation whereby a lot of people in, even in Qatar, in Maghreb, in Egypt, in Lebanon, inside Syria and in Jordan, who do not like the regime, who do not like the Assad rule for the past 40 years, but they do not want the country destroyed by certain forces in the name of fighting for freedom. So it's not as black and white as a lot of people want to see it. And if you want to be lazy and just say, well, in the end, we just need to get rid of the regime, that's fine. But you're not paying attention to the fact that when this is not happening, it's not because people support the regime. It's because people are zooming out and looking at the broader lens, and they differ with you. And it's not that they support dictatorship. So that stalemate internally is reflected regionally and is reflected internationally. Internationally, you have the United States, Great Britain primarily, and France to a certain extent, being balanced by Russia and China. And that has been evidenced by the veto by Russia and China recently. So we have a local stalemate between state and opposition. We have a regional stalemate, and then we have an international stalemate. Before I move on to talk about where this is going, let me say a couple of words about what's happening inside Syria based on independent journalist reports. And these are journalists that support different perspectives. These are not journalists that support one perspective, but they all report the same thing, which is why it has legitimacy, and I'll share that with you in a second. And based on blogs written by Syrian people sitting in their bedrooms or living rooms or cafes and blogging to the world. And also, these people are quite, many of them are not independent, but many of them are also independent, and they also support different approaches. Some don't like the regime, but also don't like the opposition. Some like the opposition no matter what, because even they say that even if the opposition is not clean completely, I'm going to support it anyway. But these two people and a variety around them are saying also some of the similar things. And this is what I want to bring to this discussion. The commonality between people who are saying the same things, even if from different perspectives, or even if they support different perspectives. What is happening in the daily battles in Syria is that the regime is actually not gaining ground. It's not gaining power in various ways. Physically and materially, if you want to think of power as divided between two dimensions, the physical material and then the soft power or question of authority and so on. Physically and materially, the regime is not necessarily gaining power. Some people say it's not losing power, but with time, with the passage of weeks and months, materially, the regime is actually also suffering from basically is being chipped at on the edges, materially speaking. And we can talk about things such as just basic maintenance issues for machines. We can talk about coordination. We can talk about various abilities to control. We can talk about its territorial shrinking. In other words, its withdrawal from certain territories in Syria because it can no longer actually maintain its presence everywhere in Syria at the same level, largely because it cannot depend on the 300,000 strong army. Because the army, whenever it shoots civilians, the number of defections increase. So you can't actually deploy your army, especially given the ethnic sectarian and makeup of the army. You cannot deploy the army at all times, everywhere. What you want to do is deploy, which is what's happening, is deploy the more loyal forces to you. And those are not in great supply. Hence, you see in Syria a strategy of repression of the opposition that starts in one city, moves to another city, and moves to another city, largely because the people doing it have to be the most loyal forces. The army can be around protecting those operations. But it's important to pay attention to that, and these things are wearing off. People get tired, and people actually, going to the second dimension, begin to lose morale. Even if they support what they're doing, begin to lose morale, the more they're killing and there's nothing that's changing. And we see a lot of desertions and defections. Oh, even though they're at lower levels, we see a lot of desertions and defections, people leaving the army. And what this has been doing in the past 6 months is that the ability of the Syrian regime to govern has diminished considerably. So physically, it's still strong and it can fight for many, many more months, because there are reserves outside Syria that will finance this, and then there's Iran, and there's China, and there's Russia. That's not a big problem. But morally, and in terms of authority, the Syrian regime is actually weakening by the week. It doesn't mean that it's actually going to fall tomorrow, but it's certainly being affected. Its ability to govern all segments and all territories of Syria has been completely demolished. Its ability to govern in the big cities is still strong, but its ability to govern outside the major cities has actually dwindled. It can only force compliance. It can only actually prevent you from doing something, but it can no longer mobilize, and that's the ability to govern, is to have some law that mobilizes people to do certain things without coercion. That ability, in my view, has gone not just now, but forever. So even if the opposition is not successful in overthrowing the regime, the Syrian regime is no longer able to restore the pre-2011 status quo because it cannot govern. Things have gotten so bad, too many people have been killed for it to be able to govern without continuous killing. And continuous killing is not governing, okay? So whatever your view is, this is a large part of the reality, that the ability to govern has been severely diminished and probably gone forever. So this is the stalemate, locally, regionally, internationally, which brings us to the last point. Where are we headed? Where are we going? And I've said this a number of times in different places, and I'm sick of myself repeating it, but it's actually what we observe for the most part in terms of where this is going. Check, check, check. Just want to make sure it's working. So where are we going? In my view, Syrian regime is actually, the conflict in Syria is slowly but definitely surely being transformed, beginning 2 or 3 or 4 months ago. Even though people say it started from the very beginning, that's not true. It started maybe in May, April, May, June, but it became more and more visible after the SNC was formed in October. What we are witnessing is a transformation of the Syrian uprising from a legitimate fight against dictatorship locally to an occasion whereby external players, regional and international, are using this opportunity to reorder power relations in the region. So we are witnessing this transformation in such a way where the original impetus for the revolution is still there, but it's being diluted by this larger picture that involves many more players that are many, much more powerful than the Syrian regime and the opposition in the direction of using this conflict as an occasion to restructure power relations in the region, to redraw the political map. And what that is doing is creating the kind of confusion that I started with when I discussed this with you and when Rami and everyone was telling me here in DC, and I this is my, you know, 32nd talk this past year on Syria. Everyone has this kind of a position, which I kind of have as well, and that is there's a struggle inside me, even if I know where my politics is, even if I know that I'm opposed to the regime, even if I know that I'm opposed to the politics, the foreign policy of the United States or Saudi Arabia or Qatar, there is still a struggle inside, because analytically I can be opposed to both, but empirically, in terms of what to do next, it's difficult to actually translate that theoretical, analytical principle into what should happen next. And the only way I see out of this, for those of us who don't live, you know, inside Syria at the time, is to actually support an independent opposition that is capable not only of overthrowing the regime, but that is capable of building an independent Syria after the regime has fallen. Because the existing opposition, in so many ways, is not capable of, first of all, overthrowing the regime on its own, and second, is not actually acting independently. And that is extremely scary in a situation where so many people want the regime to fall for the wrong reasons, because they are concerned about resistance to Israel, because they are concerned about an impediment to stability in the region, like the Gulf Arab countries, or because they're concerned about Hezbollah and its power and they want to wipe it out, or they're concerned about Iran's alleged nuclear weapons program. So there are too many messy things by problematic actors that are being sought out here in the name of fighting with the Syrians against the dictatorship. And I personally do not take this fight as a fight for democracy. I see it in much more cynical and insidious terms. So I'm not here to say what we should do next, although I think this is a discussion that people who care about the situation should have. I certainly do not support external military intervention in Syria, because it will produce many more deaths inside Syria. Syria is not Libya. Libya had a fort for the opposition, a launching pad for the opposition in Benghazi that was used as a launching point or a starting point. Syria does not have that. Syrian opposition and loyalists and people in between all live in the same places. Any kind of campaign is going to lead to the killing of tens of thousands of people, far more than what has already happened and the number of people that have been killed. In Libya, before NATO intervened, we had 1,500 people killed. After NATO intervened, we have 25,000 to 30,000 people killed. So we're not talking about being cold-hearted and inhumane when we oppose certain plans. We're talking about actually being calculating and realizing that the intervention in foreign military terms will produce many, many more deaths and will not produce a conclusive end. The Syrian regime leaving or staying is not a conclusive end. It depends on how it's done. If it's done locally, it's one thing. If it's done with external military support, it's another. And it's going to largely produce another Iraq and another Libya, where now, I don't need to tell you, if you're paying attention, what's happening in Libya, we have a disaster on our hands. And this disaster is not unrelated to the manner in which Gaddafi was actually ousted. And I'm not saying that it's the same exact situation. I'm just trying to bring to the discussion the danger that is involved in simply saying, let's use any means to get the regime out. I want to oppose any dictatorship, including the Syrian dictatorship. The question is how and at what price. So I will stop here, and hopefully we can talk about the other topics.